Greetings and salutations, my friends. It's your old pal Ariel Helwani on this Wednesday, July 17, 2019. Welcome to a brand new episode of the MMA Reporters. I am in New York City, as always. And as always, we have a lot to discuss on this Wednesday afternoon. Hope you're having a great week. I appreciate everyone who continues to rate, subscribe, and download the podcast, not just this one, but the Monday one as well. I appreciate it more than you know. And I love doing this particular one because this is when we get to talk to the media about what's going on in the sport, get a bit of a perspective from Saturday, look ahead to this weekend, and of course, all the news that is going on in the very busy world of mixed martial arts. Later in the program, we're going to be joined by my old pal, New York Rick, talk to him about this weekend's card in San Antonio. San Antonio, UFC back. Deep in the heart of Texas, main event, Leon Edwards against Rafael Dos Anjos. What exactly is at stake in this fight? I'm not quite sure. I mean, it's an important fight. I don't think a title shot is at stake. There's a winning streak on the line as far as Leon Edwards is concerned, 7 in a row. He reminds me of the Tim Duncan of mixed martial arts. And it's fitting that this fight is happening in San Antonio. You know, quiet, not really braggadocious, doesn't puff his chest out, just gets wins. And unfortunately for him, there's not a lot of support for him to get a title shot. Unfortunately for him, he was essentially assaulted backstage in London by Jorge Masvidal, and Masvidal is now a bigger star and appears to be on the cusp of either a title shot or something big. And now here he is, you know, headlining a fight night against Rafael Dos Anjos, a really tough guy, a guy in Rafael Dos Anjos who has fought them all. He's gone up against everyone. Oh, you want to fight Colby Covington on a winning streak? Sure. Oh, you want to come back and fight Kamaru Usman, who's very much like Colby Covington and appears to be a bad matchup for you? Sure. Oh, you want to fight Kevin Lee, who's moving up to 170, who's a wrestler as well, who appears to be more comfortable at 170? Sure. This guy fights everyone. Doesn't complain. Takes this fight on 30 days' notice. He's had an amazing career. He's a good soldier. So that's happening this weekend. We'll talk to New York Rick about that and some of the other interesting fights on the card. Later on, we'll talk to Mark Raimondi about some weight-cutting stuff stemming from the Aspen Ladd situation and get his thoughts on that. He covers that as well as anyone. Also talk to him a bit about the Bellator tournament that was officially announced earlier this week. But first, let's go to Sin City and say hello to my colleague over at ESPN.com and all ESPN platforms. The great Brett Okamoto joins us right off the top. Brett, how are you?
I'm good, man. What's up, Ariel Helwani? It's been a while since I spoke to you on this platform, at least.
Yes. And for the record, we've tried, but you're just a very busy man. You're traveling all over the place.
I'm too busy for you.
You're too busy for our little podcast. You're all over the place. Greenville, Sacramento, Las Vegas, of course. So thank you for carving out some time for us here. We do appreciate us. You know, like the little minions who, you know, do podcasts and stuff. We're not so famous, but
I felt like I had to. You'd been badgering me for so long about it that you guilted me into it finally.
I appreciate that. Very kind of you. Actually, let's start there. Let's start with this weekend. Actually, no, before we get to this weekend, I want to ask you about yesterday. You were at the Contender Series show. I've seen the Apex from my television, but I haven't had the pleasure of being there. And I don't think I've talked to you about it yet. What is it like in there? What's the scene like? What's the buzz like? What's it like watching fights there compared to the old Tough studio?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be tough to beat the Tough gym, right? I mean, because I, like you, I've been around this sport for a long time, and there was a lot of history in that gym. I mean, there was, in a sense of just memorabilia on the walls, but then also just everything that had happened in that building. You know, I mean, there was something special about driving over behind the Palms is where that building was located, and this little type of almost kind of half strip mall, half, you know, industrial kind of garage looking area. It was very nondescript. You wouldn't know it if it was there unless you were looking for it. And I mean, this is a lot of history of this sport that took place in that building. So it's always sad to move on from that, but you know, the building, the new building, the Apex Center, is everything you would imagine it to be. I mean, it's got that new car smell, you know. I mean, they've spared no expense. It's got everything that they want and need. It's you know, built specifically to have those live events and to, you know, to, with all the lights and the production value and everything else. So it's, I mean, it's definitely a step up, but I'll miss the Tough Gym, of course.
Do you think sooner rather than later there will be a lot more live fights coming out of that venue, not just Contender Series? Do you get the sense that this is happening soon?
Yeah, this year for sure. I mean, you're going to start seeing live events there pretty frequently, and it's not just like Dana White rhetoric. I mean, I've heard from multiple people that the goal is to essentially have a live event there almost every single day, which seems crazy to me. But
what?
That is the goal that they have set.
Yeah. Wow. It's a huge deal for them, because when you want to be in the business of, you know, owning your own content and selling this to other territories, like, not all these things have to air here in the United States. Of course, they can air on Fight Pass or ESPN Plus. But if you're able to produce live fights almost on a daily basis, you're going to be killing it financially. Like, that is a massive thing for them if they're able to pull it off. Do you get the sense that boxing will be involved in this? Like, is this their way of dipping their toe finally into that boxing world?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of different ways that they're planning on dipping their toe in the boxing world, but this is certainly one of them. Yeah, I mean,
you feel, you know, like that's still going to happen, because we're approaching 2 years now since the inception of Zuffa boxing as a thing, right? And no fights yet.
Yeah, I still think it's going to be a thing. I do. I think you know, White is definitely interested in it. I mean, we've seen now that Endeavor has gone public, and so that you know, draws in some cash that they have that could you know, finance something, that some type of move into boxing by Dana White. I don't know. I still don't know exactly what it's going to look like. I mean, he himself continues to say he doesn't know exactly what it's going to look like. But yeah, I mean, they're going to have. I mean, specifically, White has referenced an amateur boxing show at the Apex Center in the fall, and he even mentioned that he would like to put his son on it, because his son is doing amateur boxing. So that's going to happen. By fall, they're going to start having amateur boxing events there, at least one of them, and his son is supposedly going to be on it.
Wow, that is wild. Okay, let me ask you one more thing about Contender Series. Anyone thus far jump out at you as a potential star? Like, I don't know if we've seen a Sean O'Malley type or a Macy Barber type, but anyone that really has piqued your interest?
Yeah, I'm trying to think back. You know, it's so crazy. I mean, like, with a fight every weekend, and then you're talking about fights every Tuesday, it's hard to keep track of them all. But this guy, Obey, from Jamaica last night, I mean, a bantamweight, he got the armbar submission win. I forget the name of his opponent, but he definitely impressed me seeing him in person. I mean, the level of confidence that he had, the calmness that he had in that type of setting. I mean, that's a nerve wracking setting. It sounds crazy. I mean, I've never been in a UFC fight, obviously, so I can't say this out of experience. But I gotta believe that sometimes it's more nerve wracking to go into that quiet arena or at Apex, where there's not many people there, and it just feels very strange, you know, and there's a lot on the line, a UFC contract potentially on the line. I would think that there would be more pressure almost in that setting than sometimes even a UFC pay-per-view. Maybe I'm totally off on that, but that's how I read it, you know, when I'm there and I'm seeing it for myself in person. And the confidence that kid showed yesterday really impressed me. So yeah, he's one that sticks out.
Well, I don't think you're wrong, because, you know, typically you're fighting on a UFC card, even if you're the first fight of the night. All you have to do is win in that regard. Here, not only do you have to win, but you actually have to impress someone. And like, right, the standard has been set. So, and it's quiet, and there's all this pressure on you because it's your debut. So I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of those fighters who have been in both situations would say, yeah, the Contender Series setting is a little more nerve-wracking. All right, so that train continues to roll along. I want to go now to this past weekend. You were in Sacramento. And I was jealous that you got to experience that, because I've been to a few Uriah Faber fights in Sacramento, always fun. But to see him get his quickest finish, 46-second TKO in his comeback fight at the new arena in Sactown, where he's, you know, the most famous athlete maybe to ever come out of that neck of the woods. Could you describe, A, what it was like when he came out to California Love, and then what it was like when he won the fight?
Yeah, I mean, him coming out to California Love, I would almost say that it's like he never left. I mean, that's what it felt like. And I know that, you know, because he was coming back, you want to ratchet it up to 10 or whatever, but it's always a 10. I mean, you've been there. You've seen it for yourself in Sacramento. I mean, sometimes you can't go higher than 100%. And that's just like the energy that Uriah brings to the table, you know. And he didn't seem nervous, obviously, at all. He didn't seem like it was, I mean, I saw his interview with you, and you asked him, like, where does that rank in terms of moments in your career? And he's like, I've had moments like that. And he's being honest. I mean, he's had so many big moments in his career that I wouldn't necessarily even say that that was, you know, one of the biggest ones, but it was just so nice to after the time off, you know, it was almost kind of like nostalgic in a way. It was like a blast from the past. It was like watching a movie that you had, you know, one of your favorite movies that you hadn't seen in a few years. It was sort of like that, you know. It was just instantly back to what it always had been when Uriah walked out at ARCO, you know, during the WEC days and the UFC days. I mean, he was always so big, even back then, that it was nostalgic in a way. And then the fight started, and honestly, I'm probably being a little bit dramatic here, but it kind of had the feel of you know, man, this is going to go the way that we sort of are accustomed to. You know, when guys step away from the sport, they're 40 years old, and they try to come back against a young guy. I mean, it's not that Ricky Simon was dominating that fight, but he landed a big left hand. He landed a nice hard leg kick. And you just started to almost kind of immediately, at least I did, have that feeling of like, man, I hope this doesn't just go really terrible for Uriah. You know, not that I was jumping to that conclusion, but the part of me was like, man, I hope this doesn't, you know, go south real quickly. And then bang, he just lands that huge right hand. And you could tell Ricky was hurt real bad by it immediately. And the crowd was nuts. It was, it was definitely special to see that finish in person, for sure.
Yeah, nostalgic is a great way to describe it, because it gave me like a warm feeling inside. You know, we just did our mid-year awards, and I kind of regretted submitting mine before the fight, because I would say it's like one of my favorite moments of the year. You know, it's only been 7 months in, but like, just to see him, of all people, a pioneer, and like you said, we are accustomed to seeing these 40-year-old guys come back in combat sports, whether it's MMA or boxing, and it usually doesn't go very well, especially against someone who's 10 years younger than them, especially when you're a +325 underdog going into the fight. Like, this doesn't happen. It's a very, very rare thing. We just had the, you know, the super depressing scene with Chuck Liddell, and, you know, Faber not quite as old and also hasn't taken the shots that Liddell has taken, and the layoff wasn't as long. But I was sort of watching it with one eye open, and then when it seemed like he got rocked early on, I was like, oh no, this is horrible. And then he pulled that off. It was incredible. It was so much fun to watch. And not that I was rooting against Simone or rooting for Faber, but to see it like that, and then to see Simone, the way he handled it afterwards with the shout out on Twitter, it was a really great scene. And then, of course, Faber is always so smart. He's always, you know, he's always very methodical and calculated and very smart when it comes to the business side of the game. He responds to Henry Cejudo, who gave him the opening. Cejudo called him out first. He mentioned his name first. He responds to him, and then they go back and forth on Twitter, and now this is turning into a thing. And so I'll ask you, are you buying or selling this? Do you want to see Uriah Faber fight for the 135-pound title in his next fight?
In his next fight, no, of course not. You know, and I mean, I'm sorry if I sound, you know, heartless for saying that, but I mean, come on. Henry Cejudo is a two-division champion. He's got contenders at 125 and 135. And as much as we all love Uriah, and I'm sure like the entire sport, it seems like universally, is happy for him to see him come back. And just to add to your point real quickly about, you know, a guy coming back after some time off, I think it's also fun to just recognize and see a guy who was part of I don't, you know, it wasn't the dark ages of mixed martial arts, but pioneer is the correct word. And he didn't, I mean, Uriah Faber has done obviously very, very well for himself, and he is one of the smartest, most savviest businessmen in this entire industry. But he came along at a time in which his earning power was just limited. You know, it's not what it would have been if he would have came along in his prime right now. You know, and I think he obviously is aware of that. And so to see him come along in this new, you know, ESPN era, and to have that type of performance, and you know, be able to even call out the champion and have, you know, us talk about it on a podcast is fun, you know, because you feel sometimes for those pioneers who came along and really carried this sport for a long time, the face of lighter weight classes, but they weren't making those million-dollar paychecks that are occasionally available to some of the bigger stars of the sport now, you know, and I think that Uriah is definitely aware of that. So that was a cool, you know, little aspect to this weekend as well. But as far as getting back to your question of facing Henry Cejudo has a lot of challengers, man. I mean, Aljamain Sterling is there. Piotr Jan is there. I believe Joseph Benavidez should be next. I think Joe has done, you know, above and beyond anything that it would require to get a rematch against Cejudo, a guy he's beat, and then a title shot, you know, his first title shot since, what, is it 2013? I mean, the guy's won 9 out of 10 fights in the last 6 years. The only fight he lost was when he injured his knee. I mean, I think that fight needs to happen. There's other guys who are far more deserving of it, competitively speaking, than Uriah right now.
Yeah. Uriah has three fights left on his deal. And to your point, I think he sees some of the money some of the older guys are making, in particular outside of the UFC. And he's thinking, all right, it's time for me to cash in as well. So I wonder if he's going to be active. And we have to note that Cejudo's out for quite some time. Like, he's probably not going to return this year. And then we'll see when he returns early next year. So I feel like it would be kind of crazy for him to even wait, even if that is presented to him. But it does seem like they're not going to go in the direction of Faber. And I saw Dana White tell, I believe, TMZ that he wants Cejudo to defend that 125-pound title. And I couldn't agree with you more. It has to be Joseph Benavidez. I would have argued that it should have been Joseph Benavidez after the fight in January. He's the only guy. He's done a great job. He doesn't ruffle feathers or talk a lot of trash, but the results speak for themselves, and he has a win over Henry Cejudo. So is it possible? Like, now can we officially say, after all, like, we've been talking, the one ongoing storyline from January 1st, essentially, up until now, has been the flyweights. Like, this thing, we don't know where it stands. We don't know what, like, every day it changes. But I feel like on this July 17th, like, can we officially say Henry Cejudo saved the flyweights? I feel like they're here. I feel like they're adding people now.
I don't know if we can officially say it, but we can kind of not officially say it, right? And that's sort of how this sport goes, is that you can't commit too hard to anything because it feels like things change on a dime. But, yeah, I mean, they're signing more flyweights. You hear rumblings every now and then of sort of, you know, potential matchups or plans that they may have for that division, and they're not talking about it like it's dead anymore. They're not talking about it like it's, you know, just this thing on borrowed time. I think, you know, you can't say it's official and they haven't come out and set a plan for it, but yeah, I mean, it's been on life support, I feel like, for the last 8 months. And I was convinced, entirely convinced, and you know this because I've told you this multiple times, you know, you and I have had these conversations that, like you mentioned, this topic has been ongoing for months. Every time I said, it's going away, it's going away, it's going away. I have no faith that they keep it around. And I'm on the other side now. I think it's sticking. Henry Cejudo did it. I can't believe it. I don't exactly even know how he did it, but I think he did.
It's amazing. It really is, because it definitely seemed like it was dead. It felt very awkward in January when he asked Dana White point blank at that press conference in Brooklyn, if he beats TJ, does he get to, you know, save the division? And even after that, they wouldn't commit to it. And even in June, they wouldn't commit to it. And now all of a sudden, he's talking about Joseph Benavidez, and rightfully so. Benavidez just won last month against Formiga. Great win. And I think that Cejudo putting himself out there, as much as people talk about the cringe stuff and his interviews and, you know, how he comes off a little corny, I think he single-handedly did it. And not just by his wins. I think we have to admit that all the antics outside, some way, somehow, a light went off in the exec's head and said, like, this guy is worth keeping a division around. And I think to all of us, we all agreed it had to stay. Why would you get rid of the division, especially now that you have Cejudo leading the charge and there's so much to work with there? And some way, somehow, I don't know what did it. Like, no one has actually come out and, to your point, said that it has been saved. But it's pretty darn remarkable, because this thing was on its deathbed. Like, they were getting rid of – it was pretty much told to all the managers, like, either your fighter, if he just came off a loss, he's done at 125, or if he's coming off a win, he can move up to 135. Like, it was dead, and some way he did it. Yeah. It's remarkable. It really is.
I don't feel like it's bulletproof yet, though. You know, I think it's
going to
stick. I think it's going to stick around, and I do think that Cejudo is going to defend his 125-pound division or his 125-pound title. But, you know, could I sit here and say with supreme confidence that within like 3 years it'll still be around? I don't know. I mean, I still think that it's kind of, I don't want to say a case by case basis, but it just seems to me like if the UFC made a business decision at one point that was like, hey, this flyweight thing is not working out, it's better for us and our bottom line if we just don't have it anymore, I have a hard time just thinking that, you know, Henry Cejudo came along and did the cringe stuff and the triple C stuff, and now it's just bulletproof and it's there for the, you know, permanently again. I think it's still in a state of, you know, if I'm a flyweight, I kind of have my fingers crossed all the time, but it's, to your point, I mean, it's just in a far, far better position than it was before. I mean, I think it could stick around a long time for, you know, permanently, and I hope it does. But I'd still be, you know, crossing my fingers if I was a flyweight.
And I don't know what it says about the state of the 125ers or the female 145ers, but I like the fact Remember when Conor won his second belt, when DC won his second belt, right away, you know, Dana White was saying, okay, you have to give one up, right? But with Cejudo, he's not saying that about 125 or 135. With Amanda Nunes, not saying that about 135 and 145. And if they don't say that, I feel better about these, you know, double champ situations, because what's the whole point if you're going to have someone move up, get another belt, and then take the belt away from them? Like, you want to see if they can defend both. I think it presents a problem in terms of scheduling and one division is being tied up. But if you're actually going to do it and put a fighter in that situation, then to take it away from them feels very hollow, in my opinion. So I like that recently with Cejudo and Nunes in particular, they're not saying that anymore. Did you notice that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and of course, you know, it adds more value to it if you actually feel like they are the champion of two divisions and not just some, you know, placeholder holding a belt of a division that really doesn't exist anymore. I mean, I think the circumstances for each are a little bit different, obviously. I mean, the 145-pound female division was always such an awkward, weird situation in and of itself. But yeah, of course. I mean, if they're not saying, hey, these divisions are going away and we don't even want to be in business with these divisions, then of course it adds more value to it. I got to say real quick, Ariel, I'm like thinking in the back of my head still about our conversation about Uriah real quickly. I want to ask you a question, because you bring up, you know, him wanting to potentially fight out his contract and cash in. There's also like the other side of it that isn't there an argument to be made that the one thing that Uriah should absolutely 1,000% do is preserve the interest that's in his fight with TJ Dillashaw? Oh. I mean, like that would almost be like goal number one is to do nothing that would lower interest in a fight between him and TJ when he comes back, right?
It's funny because I was just about to ask you about TJ and say how it's like now it's kind of setting in that it's so sad that we don't have him at our disposal. That, I mean, he's doing his time and he's doing so willingly and he's rehabbing at the same time, all that. But like, right, could you imagine? All right, you're not getting Cejudo, but you're going to get TJ Dillashaw in, I don't know, December or something. Like could you imagine? Like, it's just, that is the fight in many respects that's almost bigger than Cejudo if you eliminate the titles. So yeah, I agree with you, but then you have to consider the fact that, all right, he's only going to come back in a year and a half. That's when he's eligible to come back.
I know,
back,
it's TJ. So long.
It's so long.
So far away.
So then if your favor...
But if you're Uriah, you can't go out there and lose, you know, you could potentially lose a couple fights. I guess you could. The interest would still be there because the storyline will always be there. But in a way, to me, like, if I'm Uriah, I'm almost wondering, what is the best way for me to cash out here? What is the way for me to maximize,
well,
you know,
I feel like I have the answer. The answer, in my opinion, is... fight these three fights, and like if you're doing three fights, that's pretty much going to take you to a year and a half, right? Could you imagine, and I know a lot has to happen, but could you imagine if he goes 3-0 in his next three, and that would include the last one, so it would be 4-0 since coming back, and now all of a sudden here's TJ Dillashaw, like that fight is now gigantic.
Yeah.
And also he cashes in because he's a free agent as that fight is like right there. Like you go through the three fights, you win them all, your stock couldn't be higher, and oh, by the way, there's a money fight just sitting there at the other end of the rainbow.
Ariel, you were worried about Uriah as you walked out to the cage at 40. Now you want him to fight three times the next 18 months and go 3-0.
That's right. Listen, I said I'd never doubt him again. Here's the thing. I wasn't necessarily worried about him. I just didn't like the fact that it felt like he was being used as a stepping stone in his hometown for Ricky Simone. And anyone who says that wasn't the case, I say you're a liar. He was a +325 underdog. Ricky Simone was the youngster. They were trying to build a star off of Uriah Faber's back. And Faber said, no, I'm going to beat the guy in 46 seconds. Why else do you do the matchup? Like, there's nothing for Faber to gain from that fight. It was all for Ricky Simone to gain.
I think if you're Uriah, what you do is okay, you want a title shot. All right, you're never too far away from a title shot, right? You're never that far away, but you're probably not going to get it immediately. You know, so take another fight at 135 that could be your one fight to then get to the title, okay? So you're taking a fight, and if you win it, then, you know, there's a real good chance he could get a title fight if he wins one more against a ranked opponent. So, but if he loses, then it's like, okay, well, no harm done, because then maybe, you know, you take a step back, you hang out for a while, and you preserve that TJ Dillashaw fight, and maybe you can negotiate with the UFC in terms of, because what they should really be doing, if he and TJ were both smart, TJ should be doing this too, And I know that TJ is a little bit of a different scenario because he's trying to be quiet in the media right now, and he doesn't want to, you know, the spotlight on him, and he's kind of taking a step back, which is smart to do. But at a certain time, you know, he's got to start talking about that fight. He's got to start talking about, all right, I want Uriah when I come back, you know, and imagine they can build this fight up without Uriah even fighting again over the next 18 months if they really wanted to. Right. I mean, they could strategically build this fight and get it as big or close to as big as if Uriah was out there winning fights.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see what they do with him. So in conclusion, we agree Cejudo, Benavidez, and then probably Sterling, Jan, let Faber do his thing and see how that pans out, whether it's Dillashaw or eventually earns a title shot. Last thing, do we do interim title for Sterling, Jan? I say no. What do you say? The belt was just defended in June, or it was on the line, vacant title, in June. Come on, no interim title.
In June? Yeah, I agree. No interim title.
I say do it in New York, MSG. You've got Sterling from Long Island. You've got the great Russian population in New York City. Big fight, number one contender fight. Have the winner face Cejudo after he fights Benavidez.
I agree. Yeah. Or I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to seeing it in a main event just to be five rounds.
Right.
I would love to see a fight like that be five rounds. But yeah,
Moscow.
I mean, MSG wouldn't.
Fyodor
Jan
in Moscow against Aljamain, main event fight night.
Yeah, that one's the beat though, headlining that card. I think.
Oh.
I think that would be my guess as of right now, is that they wanted to beat to headline that card. But
okay,
we'll see. I mean, there's not a bad option between those two, Pierre Jan or Zabit. I think you get a win either way.
Yep. All right. Great stuff, Brett. Thank you very much for the insight. We'll talk to you soon.
Yep. Sounds good.
All right. There he is, Brett Okamoto of ESPN joining us. Before we move along now to Mark Raimondi, let me tell you about my good friends over at Cheap Heat. By the way, I feel like I give Cheap Heat a plug every week. Are they giving me plugs?
Yes, they are.
Okay, thank you, Troy. I just wanted to make sure. I mean, really, it's just a lot of love that I give these guys. But you know what? They deserve it. This week, by the way, the great Peter Rosenberg and Stat Guy Greg, they have a major disagreement about Extreme Rules. Extreme Rules. ECW. The old days. You know what I'm talking about. Plus, Bray Wyatt is back and much more. New episodes of Cheap Heat every Friday, and you can find them wherever you get your podcasts. All right. Now let's move along now to someone who knows a thing or two about Cheap Heat. Not the podcast, just getting Cheap Heat. I mean, have you seen his Twitter feed? It's filled with bad puns and dad jokes, even though he's not even close to being a dad. I mean, it's amazing. Mark Raimondi joining us now from Los Angeles. Mark, how are you?
Oh, I'm fantastic, Ariel. I like how you have the pro wrestling podcast ad leading into my MMA reporter appearance.
It's almost like we planned it. Although you tried to cancel on me, I'm breaking kayfabe here, but you tried to cancel me. Why did you try to cancel on me moments ago, Mark?
Okay, I did not try to cancel.
No, you sort of did.
Incorrect.
For a minute there, I almost had to like drag you back in. Like you were trying to move away, and I was like, come on, you can't cancel.
No. So to break down the fourth wall here, we were supposed to do this an hour earlier. When I was home, I was all ready. I was prepared to have another fantastic appearance on the MMA Reporters. And you text me about 25 minutes out and say, can't do the show, got to push it back an hour later.
I got screwed.
And right now, I'm standing in Burbank, California,
outside
Morton Steakhouse, where there's a Bellator Media Day going on. So I don't know how good my audio is. I can't hear you all that fantastic. Would have been so much better an hour earlier, but here I am. I'm powering through just for you.
Well, you're such a pro. Yes, I agree. Would have been better an hour earlier. I've just been sitting on the couch here in New York at the Seaport Studios. They double booked us, and the lack of respect that I continue to receive here is palpable. But nevertheless, we're pros, and we shall forge on. And I appreciate you carving out some time, just like Brett. It's like I have to beg all of you just to appear on the podcast. Like you're doing me a favor by me putting you over on this show. But, you know, that's the way it goes sometimes. So let's not waste any more of your time. Let's talk first. I'm going to ask you about the Bellator thing because you're there.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you about Aspen Ladd because, like I said at the top of the show, you follow the commission stuff, the regulation stuff better than anyone. Aspen Ladd on the scale Friday, shivering, shaking, in pain. When you saw that, what did you think?
I was horrified. It looked awful. It looked really bad. We've all seen so many weigh-ins, and we've seen some really bad ones, and that was up there. That was a rough thing to watch. the way that she was moving, it looked like she was in pain. It really looked like she was in pain. And I thought that she was either going to miss weight or the fight was going to be called off. And my immediate reaction was, this is not good. This is very bad.
What did the California State Athletic Commission do in order to determine that she was fit to fight?
They had their doctors examine her right away, and they checked her to see how badly or how much she was dehydrated, how severely she was dehydrated. They checked her vital signs. They did all those things. They do that usually before fighters weigh in, or at least that morning. This one they did an extra because they wanted to make sure that they wanted to see where she was at health wise, and the doctors determined that she was actually okay. The doctors determined that she was actually really not as bad as it may have appeared to the naked eye. I spoke to one of the CSAC ringside physicians who examined her, Dr. Gary Furness, and he told me that she actually was not severely hydrated. There was still moisture in her mucous membranes. Like, I'm not a doctor, I guess that is something significant. He checked her vital signs. It was normal. It was not out of the ordinary. And once she started to get some fluid back in her system, she was fairly normal again. And they wrote off. And I know that people kind of mocked this when I reported it the other day, but the CSAC doctors actually wrote it off as really just her having nerves. Like, she may have had something kind of like an anxiety attack or a panic attack, out of fear of missing weight, out of fear of blowing her main event opportunity. And that's really what caused the kind of the visceral reaction, not so much dehydration. That is what they said. And, I'm not a doctor, so I guess you have to go by what the doctor says.
So I've reached out to some people about this, and I know I'm sort of putting you on the spot here, but I'm wondering if you have heard the same or if you're thinking of the same thing. I don't know. I haven't been able to find any science that suggests, given her state, given her, you know, her dehydration, given the way she was feeling, she is then more likely to not be able to take that punch that she took on Saturday night against Jermaine Durandamy. Do you think that there's a correlation between how she looked, how she felt on Friday, and how quickly that fight ended on Saturday?
There very well could be, and it's one of those things where you can never say for sure, Ariel. I mean, even if you ask the doctor, even if you ask someone who knows about this kind of stuff, they can never say for sure. But there are, I've spoken to so many doctors over the years about weight cutting and severe dehydration, and the fact is, there is no way to completely rehydrate, to completely replenish the water in your cells, in your body, in 24 hours, or in this case, like 36 hours, especially when it's a very severe weight cut, when it's a very severe dehydration. Sometimes it can take 72 hours or more, and this was about 36 hours. Now, does that play a part in the brain and how a chin or a head can withstand the punch? It could. No one knows really for sure because it's a hard thing to experiment on. But there are doctors who have theorized just that one of the things when weight cutting comes into play, doctors will say that a fighter has a harder time taking a punch when they are dehydrated, and you just can't rehydrate all of that fluid back into your body that fast and around the brain. It just doesn't happen that fast.
I'm happy about the fact that this situation happened in California, and as I've said before, and I believe you agree, California right now, as far as commissions are concerned, the gold standard, Andy Foster, the best as far as executive directors / commissioners in the world of combat sports. But I'm wondering, in your expert opinion, we being promoters / commissioners / regulators, are we doing enough to avoid a true tragedy in mixed martial arts when it comes to weight cutting? Like, to me, in my opinion, what I'm getting at is, if you watched that scene on Friday and did nothing about it and didn't go back on Monday as a regulator, as a promoter, and say, all right, are we doing enough? Should we be stricter? Should we be monitoring? Should she have fought? All these things and more. Then you're part of the problem. You weren't part of the problem in terms of her her particular weight cut. But if you're not always trying to tweak this and make this better and make this safer and avoid tragedies, whether it's stopping fights from happening given the state that these athletes are in, you're part of the problem as well. And so I'll ask you, do you feel like enough is being done on both sides of the fence, regulation and promotion, to avoid a tragedy? Because thus far as North America is concerned, we have avoided tragedies. We've come close, it seems, but we haven't had a true tragedy as a result of weight cutting. Do you think enough is being done?
Well, not at the highest level, but there have been fighters who have died from extreme weight cutting in North America, in the United States. Just not in the UFC.
That's what I meant. Like, if something happened in the UFC, I was specifically talking about the UFC, but it's a great point. I was on Outside the Lines talking about Aspen Ladd and nothing happened, right, at the end of the day. Could you imagine if something truly did happen in the UFC or Bellator? It would be a huge tragedy, obviously, but the sport would suffer greatly as a result, and rightfully so.
We're not doing enough. The people that need to be stepping in and doing things are not doing enough. And I know the California Commission and Andy Foster have tried their best to put in rules and regulations, but if no other commission is going to kind of go along with it, it's very hard to. There's not a lot of teeth in it. It's only going to be one state doing it, and this happened in California, and she still fought. So where there are these. It's very difficult because honestly, for the most part, the UFC and fighters, especially, I feel like they've kind of resigned themselves to the fact that weight cutting and extreme weight cutting is going to be a part of the sport no matter what, even though it doesn't really have to be. It doesn't really have to be, but they've resigned themselves that it's going to be a part of the sport no matter what, and that is a deep rooted feeling with many fighters, and I think with the UFC as well, and I don't know if things will change unless that changes. And the UFC still has, the commissions can do whatever they want, regulators can do whatever they want. But if we're being honest here, the UFC is really the stakeholder that matters in all of this. And it is really only until they do something that any change, any kind of significant change really gets made, in my opinion.
What can they do?
I mean, you could do what ONE Championship did and move every single fighter up one weight class just right off the bat. You could do that tomorrow and just say, you know what? You're a featherweight. All right, now you're fighting a lightweight. That's it. Everyone does that. It's radical.
That's drastic. Yeah.
And I'm not holding my breath. But I mean, that would be. I mean, I would say 75% or more of fighters are cutting a good amount of weight. Right.
Oh yeah.
Do you think that would be a fair statement? Maybe even more.
If not more, yeah.
If not more. So I think it's a really hard thing to do, man. And I mean, I've written about this so much. I've probably written more words on this than anyone else, and maybe more words than on this than I've written about anything else. I don't know the solution, but I really think that people need to work together. There was a weight cutting summit in 2015 that was called by the California Commission, and a lot of the stakeholders showed up, and it was a good discussion. It might be time to get back and do that again, I think, and have everyone in the room and have a real discussion about this with doctors and with fighters. Fighters need to come to this too.
Absolutely.
It's very important.
Fighters, coaches, managers, nutritionists, trainers, all those people and more. And so let me ask you about Aspen Ladd. So she's had two fights canceled, 24 hours before the event. The Jessica I one, they said she was sick, but, given her history, how could you ignore the fact that she's had a history with weight cutting and not make that correlation? The Leslie Smith fight was because of weight cutting. That got canceled in Invicta. She missed weight.
Yep.
Here we have this situation. Do you think it's time she fights at 145?
I don't know. I can't say for sure because I'd never looked at any of her data. I know that the UFC Performance Institute has a way of looking at the body and taking measurements and data and that kind of thing and seeing what the ideal weight class is for a fighter. I don't know. I really don't know. It's one of those things like is she doing it the wrong way? I mean, to the naked eye, again, what the hell do I know? But to the naked eye, she doesn't look like she's much bigger than these other 135 pounders, right?
Right.
She doesn't appear to be. And I mean, Jermaine Duranemi looks bigger than her, but for whatever reason, it's not working out as far as the weight cut goes. And she made it. last Friday, but it was certainly on the cusp. So I really don't know. I really don't know what it is. Maybe it would benefit her to go to the UFC PI and do her weight cut there, or at least have someone help her. I'm not sure. I don't know if she has a George Lockhart or a Tyler Minton. I don't believe she has someone like that, a Mike Dolce. I don't know. I mean, I think that she needs to try something else, but I can't say for sure that she needs to go to 145. I just don't know.
Here's why she has to go to 145. Here's why it makes too much sense to go to 145. Who's the champion at 145? Amanda Nunes. Who's the champion at 135? Amanda Nunes.
Yes.
What do you want? You want a shot at the champion. You wanted to win this fight to get a title shot. Well, guess what? At 145, it's pretty darn shallow. Felicia Spencer, I mean, I think right now Aspen Ladd is more well-rounded and further in her career than Spencer. The same kind of amount of fights, but I think she's a little further along with her UFC experience. She's fighting in a potential number one contender fight in less than 2 weeks. Why not go to 145? You could be in that spot. What? Right,
you and I both know, Ariel, it's not that simple. The UFC has to also agree to this.
Agree to what? Her moving to 145?
I'm going up.
What do they have to agree to? Her fighting at 145, or her getting a title shot with one victory at 145?
They have to agree to give Aspen Ladd fights at 145 pounds.
If Aspen Ladd calls them today and says, "I have too much trouble making weight at 135, I'm going to 145," they are not saying no to that. They have told guys like Kelvin Gastelum and John Lineker, "You have to move up because you're not making weight consistently in your weight class."
Yeah.
So they will be all for it, and plus they need 145ers. I mean, there's people out there that, you know.
Well, I have also heard fighters have told me, and managers told me, coaches have told me that fighters, and they have told UFC, hey, we're thinking about moving up to, you know, lightweight. And UFC said, well, I don't know if we have any fights to offer you there, so I don't know. Maybe it may take another 6 months or a year. So that's also a consideration.
Well, lest we forget, Mark Raimondi, not that long ago, they were telling flyweights that you either got to go to 135 or get the hell out. And now all of a sudden, Henry Cejudo has saved the flyweights, and they're signing flyweights. And Dana White is saying he has to fight Joseph Benavidez for the flyweight title. So crazy things happen in this sport, and opinions change. And I don't know. I just feel like she has to go to 145 just for her. We've seen too many fighters as of late, Thiago Santos, Anthony Smith, Daniel Cormier, do very well. And there's more. Michael Chiesa.
Of course.
Moving up. It's healthier. Just enjoy. You're young. 145. Just try it out. It's 10 pounds. The pool is a little shallower.
Yeah, it's not going to get easier for her.
No.
It's only going to get harder.
Yeah.
Probably. I mean, unless she figures something else out.
I also saw a lot of people saying on Saturday night that there's a tendency among referees to stop fights sooner when it's females involved. Do you feel, and again, this is just us feeling it out, there's no data to suggest it. Do you, like, when you watch fights, do you feel like referees have a tendency to stop them sooner when it's a female fight as opposed to a male fight?
I've heard that as well, and I think there are some cases where you can look at a stoppage and say that, but it's so hard. It's just so hard to say what's in a referee's mind. I mean, I don't know, man. I think that I don't. There's not, like you said, there's not enough data to support that. I think there have been cases where, okay, you see a stoppage and you think like, well, if that was a guy, if those were two guys in there, it might have continued. But I don't think. Saturday night was an indication of that. I think what her team saw was Aspen Ladd going in the wrong direction. She fell face first. And when I took John McCarthy's seminar on refereeing, when a fighter falls that way, it is a major, major red flag for a referee. They're not falling on the side. They're not falling backward, which is much more normal. When they're falling face first, that's a major, major red flag, and I think that's what Herb Dean saw, and I think he reacted to that.
I think one thing that's really interesting that doesn't get talked about enough is that fighters and referees are very much alike when it comes to confidence. Fighters on a losing streak, you'll see their confidence change. You'll see them do things that they didn't do when they were on a winning streak. And I feel like referees, especially in MMA, where the calls are, you know, they're such judgment calls, right? I mean, nothing is black and white as far as a stoppage in MMA, and you see a guy who gets criticized, who, you know, gets talked about. Oh, you were too late for a few fights in a row. You were too early for a few fights in a row. You made the wrong call here and there. And you see their confidence start to waver and you see them start to doubt themselves. And I feel like we're starting to see that with Herb Dean. I feel like he's not quite as on point as he was in the past. I still think he's one of the best ever, but I think recently he's made some questionable calls.
I think there's something to that. I think that there is a certain rhythm, the way that a fighter has, and a certain consistency that a fighter finds, and I think that happens to referees as well. And it is definitely within the realm of possibility that all of that criticism that Herb Dean has gotten for some of the late stoppages can kind of play into him stopping fights early and so on and so forth. You know what I mean? Like I think that can certainly be in his head and it can go from being gun shy, you know, to not wanting the fight to go too late. And this one was, I can understand his line of thinking, but like I said, when a fighter falls face first, that's a big red flag for a referee.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there have been other cases too where Herb Dean has made certainly disputed calls.
Great stuff as always, Mark. We went a little longer on this, and I know you have to go to the Bellator media. What is it? A media lunch or something like that?
I think there's a steak waiting for me right now.
Oh my gosh! Well, I really have to let you go. All right. Well, we'll talk to New York Rick about the tournament. I appreciate the insight as always, and enjoy the steak. Well done. Correct. That's how I like my steaks.
No. What?
What?
Medium rare.
What? The pink?
Every time.
You like the pink?
I like the red.
Ugh.
Give me. I want it to be bleeding.
I like it extra crispy.
Oh God! Yeah, I gotta go.
All right. Talk to you later. There he is, Mark Raimondi. Appreciate his time, as always. Great insight, especially when it comes to the weight-cutting stuff. All right, before we get to New York, Rick, are you tired of credit card bills with high interest rates? Ready to pay off your credit card balances and start saving money? Of course. Who isn't? From Lightstream, you can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000 with no fees. Listen to this. No application fees, no origination fees, no transaction fees, no prepayment penalties. Wow. The rate is fixed, so it will never go up over the life of the loan. Plus, you can even get your money in your bank account as soon as the day you apply. The online application is so easy. You can apply right from your phone. Voila, that easy. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Now, just for my listeners, apply now to get a special interest rate discount. Again, special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go right now to lightstream.com/Ariel. That's me, A-R-I-E-L. Again, LIGHTSTREAM, lightstream.com/Ariel. That's it. Great people. I only like to have sponsors that I believe in, people that support us, that allow us to do shows like this. So please support them. And by the way, this is subject to credit approval. Rate includes a 0.50% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com once again, /Ariel, lightstream.com/Ariel for more information. All right, New York Rick, are you there?
I am here, my friend.
It's good to talk to you. I wanted to continue this conversation from Saturday night's main event because we were talking. Ooh, Saturday night's main event. That reminds me, the old WWF days. Jermaine Durandamy, I wanted to ask you about something that she said to me on Monday that really sent chills down my spine. She said that she has been served a life sentence by the MMA community, that she'll never be accepted, that she may never get a title shot, that because of her decision to not fight Chris Cyborg, stemming from the controversial win over Holly Holm when she won that 145-pound title in 2017 in Brooklyn, she'll never be able to move on from that. And that line, life sentence, really stuck with me because we deal with a sport here filled with criminals and steroid users, bad people, and they're given second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth chances, right? And this is a person who was going through some stuff, injured, didn't want to fight Chris Cyborg, and she's been served a life sentence. This is wrong. And so I'll ask you, has Jermaine Durandamy done enough at this point to put 2017 in the rearview mirror? Do you think people are going to get behind her if she does in fact get that title shot?
So there's two questions there.
first question is, do I think she's done enough at this point? And the answer is no. I don't think she's able to erase those demons from fans' minds. I think there's a large sector of fans that think she was, quote-unquote, scared. Somebody who steps into a cage was, quote-unquote, scared to face Chris Cyborg.
By the way, someone who was also 46-0 as a kickboxer, right? I mean, scared.
Right.
Ridiculous.
Somebody who has clearly done this quite a few times was, quote-unquote, scared to do their job to go into the cage and fight somebody. But suffice it to say, I think that is a sentiment that does exist, and I don't think this one performance or anything she's done since is enough to erase that, unfortunately. But I disagree with her, in fact, in the fact that she can't erase that. I think there's quite a few things she could do to erase that. I think if she was to go on a lengthy winning streak, if she was to beat somebody like Amanda Nunes or even the aforementioned Chris Cyborg, it would instantly put those things to bed. I think, you know, MMA is a sport where there's opportunities to prove things. And this is one of those opportunities. So I do think, you know, she's in the pole position to get a title shot. It's hard to see any other contenders at either 45 or 35 that outrank her.
What about Cyborg if she wins and resigns? She's got to be number one, right?
Oh, you're saying Cyborg to face Amanda for the title?
Yeah.
Yes, certainly, but I think that's still up in the air.
Right.
You know, that is not, you know, in the cards at the moment. Jermaine Durandamy is sitting there and ready to fight. So let's exclude Cyborg for the moment. Now,
Okay. Certainly,
I think she jumps her if she comes in. But excluding Cyborg, I don't see anybody better at 35 or 45. She could be competing for either of those titles. So I think she will ultimately get this shot. I think it's hard to deny her, and I think she'll be able to put those demons to bed, actually.
Well, imagine if this win wasn't controversial, if it was a clean finish like Masvidal Askren, 16-second, incredible against a young, undefeated fighter. She'd be riding high, but unfortunately, again, like, she can't catch a break because it was controversial, it was premature. Most people think that Herb Dean stepped in a little too soon. And so what's the narrative afterwards? It's not, oh, wow, look at Jermaine Durandamy in a main event doing that to Aspen Ladd. It's premature. She didn't deserve it. And so I still feel like the fans won't really get behind it, even though I think she's done enough. I don't think she should be given a life sentence. I think that, you know, it was a bad time in her career. She made some mistakes. Let's move on. But she didn't do anything illegal per se. Unfortunately, I think for her, I'll say unfortunately, if Cyborg wins on July 27th, and maybe even if Felicia Spencer wins, but definitely if Cyborg wins and then resigns, I know those are two big ifs, especially the second one, she'll probably get the next crack at Amanda Nunes.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. It is unfortunate for somebody who has had such a fantastic career to this point and really hasn't shown a lot of vulnerability in the UFC, has really been one of the top fighters in, you know, the weight class and multiple weight classes. It's unfortunate, but I do think, you know, it's not like, let's say Cyborg does get that shot. It's not like there's a whole crop of 35ers and 45ers that are coming up. She really is, you know, in a very good position. Even if Cyborg does get that next fight, I can't see how she doesn't get an opportunity in one or two fights. She's the only one who's really made herself, you know, you put a stamp on it in both those divisions.
It makes me sad for Jermaine because she's such a nice person. She's a cop. She's got a great story. And I just feel like for whatever reason, that year was, I mean, it ended up being the worst thing to ever happen to her to win that belt. It's one of those weird ones, kind of like Nico Montaño. But again, like, she didn't do anything wrong necessarily. It was just a really weird situation where I don't think she fully explained herself properly, and the fans made up their mind because that home fight was controversial and the late punches after the bell. It just feels like she can't get rid of that stench. And then the win on Saturday didn't quite help her, unfortunately, because it was controversial. So I don't know. But I feel for her. She's such a great person. She's so nice. And I don't think she deserves a life sentence. And I wish people would forget and move on from all of that. Let me ask you about another piece of news that was broken on Monday's program. So Bellator has officially announced its 16-man featherweight tournament. Scott Coker came on the show and broke the entire field, which was very nice of him to do. And what's so interesting about this, so it's 16 men. They've done the heavyweight tournament. That was won by Ryan Bader. They're in the midst of doing the welterweight tournament, which they're going to have the final, hopefully later on this year, Douglas Lima versus Roy McDonald. Those were all 8-man tournaments. This time it's 16 men. And he told me that he announced, like, when he announced the lineup, the other fighters didn't know. And I've asked some of the other fighters and their management if that was in fact true, and they didn't know who they were fighting until he announced it, which is kind of wild. Initially, the plan was to do all 8 first-round fights on the same night, but now they've split it up over 2 nights. September 7th, the first night in San Jose. September 28th is the second half of the first round in Inglewood. These are the matchups very quickly. Cecilia Carvalho, Strauss Campos, Curran Boric, Sanchez Claxton, Pitbull Archuleta. That's the lone 5-round fight. Of course, Pitbull being the champion at 145 in the first round. But then second round and on will be all 5-round fights. McKee, Karhanian, Caldwell, Corrales, Vaishal, Rogers. And so I want to ask you about the tournament. What do you think of the tournament? But then the big thing, what I love so much about the tournament is after the first round, they're going to do this blind draw lottery thing where you pick, very much like the old K1 days, kind of like in soccer, how they do it, where you pick a ball, you go in your slot, and no one knows who they're fighting. I love this. I think this is great. I'm all for it. I love the names. I love the idea. I like the concept. I like that it's 8. It's 16 now instead of 8. This is all great. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm fully on board. There's every single matchup has intrigue. I love the way this is set up. I also do like the random draw, although I did see something Invicta did a tournament where you got to choose the person who had the fastest finish got to choose their opponent. I kind of like the intrigue of that. If you're not doing the random draw, but I'm all for the random draw, and I'm all for the fact that Coker announced it on your show on Monday.
Well, of course.
And that's when the fighters found out. So kudos to those 16 men for not, you know, giving an F about who they're going to face in the first round and saying, sign me up for this tournament, because it's champion and top ranked contenders alike. So they're putting it all on the line, and it's a fantastic tournament.
Now, the one thing that, and I think it would have been awesome if they all fought on the same night and then they did the draw like that night right after, right? Like at the end of the show, you go and you go online or whatever on their app and you watch it. The one thing that this tournament doesn't have that the other two did so far for Bellator, it doesn't have any legends per se. It doesn't have any old timers or veterans. Yeah. It's a lot of young guys. Do you like that or don't like that? Like, do you think they should have sprinkled in some?
Leave that behind.
Okay. All right.
Leave that behind. Give me the guys who are at the top of the division right now. I don't need names. I need, you know, the tournament is going to be bigger than any one name in it. That's just how this is going to work. Now, granted, Pitbull is by far the biggest name, the champion. But I think this tournament is going to represent more and be more than any one name, with all due respect to guys like Caldwell and Pitbull and McKee, who have, you know, established themselves, and Strauss. But the idea of them traversing this field of 16 to me resonates more. You know, if this was just, you know, a bunch of fights and then ultimately it, you know, nobody was told it's a tournament, it just played out as a mini tournament, nobody would care. But the idea that this is happening over the course of these 2 nights and the fact that it is a tournament is what's significant. So yeah, leave the legends behind. Give me the 16 best that they have on the roster, and I'm amped for this.
The other thing that I love so much about this is that usually the way you set up a tournament, especially with 60 men, you want, you know, the biggest fight to happen in the final. And if you showed me all these names on a piece of paper, not matched up against each other, and you said, all right, what's the biggest fight? I would say probably Pitbull versus Archuleta, given how good Archuleta has looked as of late, the streak he's on, 23-1, going up against Pitbull, the champion. Right now, that's probably the biggest fight. Maybe you can make a case for AJ McKee because he's looked so good as well. But that fight, Archuleta-Pitbull, is happening in the first round right off the bat. And so I love that they did that and didn't try to, you know, make the tournament so that those two would meet in the final. I thought that that was a cool way to start the whole thing. Okay, so that's the Bellator tournament again, September 7th, September 28th in San Jose and Inglewood, respectively. This weekend, UFC is back. That's the biggest show this weekend. There's not a lot of events this weekend. UFC in San Antonio, Leon Edwards, Rafael Dos Anjos, main event. And I was asked this question earlier, what's at stake in this fight? Leon Edwards has won 7 in a row, RDA former champ coming off that nice win over Kevin Lee. And honestly, I don't think anything is at stake other than Leon Edwards continuing his winning streak. Like, unfortunately for him, he's behind Jorge Masvidal. He's behind Colby Covington. It shouldn't necessarily be this way, but I compared him to the Tim Duncan of the UFC right now, and it's so fitting that this fight is happening in San Antonio. He's great. All he does is win, but he doesn't have that support behind him. He doesn't have that momentum, unfortunately. Am I wrong? Is it possible that he wins impressively, gets on the mic, and is able to jump Covington and Masvidal?
Absolutely not. There's no chance in the time since Leon Edwards last fought
We got the famous, the infamous, from his perspective, probably three-piece and a soda line. Masvidal established himself as one of the like true stars of this sport, but you know, a true draw right now in this sport. So unfortunately, I don't think there's anything he could do on Saturday night that would allow him to jump Masvidal or Covington. But I do think, you know, this winning streak will amount to something. That is what I ultimately feel. I feel like it will be impossible to deny Leon Edwards at some point. Just look at the names on the resume. Gunnar Nelson in the last fight, Donald Cerrone, he's beaten Brian Barberina, Vicente Luque, who looks incredible in that division, Albert Humanov, who's not there anymore, but one of the like top, was one of the top fighters in the division. This is a very impressive streak, with his last loss coming to Kamaru Usman, the champion. So it's truly a sign that, you know, the meritocracy is no longer in effect, and Leon Edwards, the fact that Leon Edwards hasn't already gotten a title shot. But I do think he ultimately will. I really do believe that there will be a time down the line where he will get it. It won't be Saturday. It won't be after Saturday night, though.
Well, if he wins on Saturday, that means he will have won 8 in a row. There's Tony Ferguson out there who's won way more than that. I think off the top of my head, 12 in a row, and he's apparently nowhere near a title shot right now. So it might be a while for Leon Edwards.
And a little bit different in that case, Tony Ferguson coming in and out of active competition. Leon Edwards not. Leon right. Edwards just continuing to kind of truck along and be there with wins over big names. But I see your point.
It might actually be like, I don't know, 2 years. If you consider the names at 170, you consider Masvidal, and you consider Covington, and then you consider Woodley potentially at some point getting a rematch with a win or two, and there's Robbie Lawler out there as well. He's in a really tough spot. Like, I can see this going to 10, 11 in a row if he continues to win. We've seen this before.
Masvidal doesn't get a title shot. Let's play, you know, fantasy. Masvidal doesn't get a title shot. Who does he fight?
With a win?
No, Masvidal.
Oh, Masvidal. Sorry, I was thinking Edwards. If he doesn't get a title. Oh,
Masvidal doesn't get the title shot.
Oh, there's only, and I saw what Dana White said to TMZ. There's only three options for Jorge Masvidal, in my opinion. There's title shot, obvious, Conor McGregor, Nate Diaz. Those are the only three options.
What about Leon Edwards with a win?
He has entered that orbit. Now, would I be in favor of Leon Edwards? Absolutely. I thought it should have been Leon Edwards versus Masvidal after the incident in March. I mean, how could you punch someone backstage and then not get the retribution? It's crazy. It's amazing that he got away with that. So I'd be all for that. I just don't see it happening. Now, maybe he gets on the mic and maybe Covington wins. Edwards gets on the mic, calls out Masvidal, but I don't see Masvidal entertaining that. I think Masvidal has reached a different stratosphere now all of a sudden. Like, I can't remember the last time so many people have come up to me about a non-Conor McGregor fight. And I'm talking about people like, you know, my kids' friends and neighborhood. Oh, you see that 5-second knockout? You see that guy on Lebatard? You see that thing that he did with Sugats? Like, he has almost reached Diaz territory now. He's a big deal. He's a big name. And I just don't see him entertaining that unless they throw a boatload of money his way. I mean, it could happen. I just don't see it happening. The Diaz fight is interesting. He kind of reminds me of like the Cuban / Miami Diaz. They're very similar in the way they act. Very similar careers, right? They've kind of, you know, they kind of have double digit losses almost, and always, you know, it always seems like they would win a couple, then lose one or not live up to their expectations. But I feel like there'll be so much mutual respect there between them that it won't even be fun. Like the build up, they'll just kind of respect each other too much. That's why all of a sudden I feel like I've turned the corner on the Conor Masvidal idea, and I really like it. I don't know if Conor is going to entertain it, but yeah, I know I'm kind of jumping around and throwing out a bunch of different scenarios, but I don't see it happening. Do you, Edwards Masvidal, if he wins and Masvidal doesn't get a title shot?
Here's how I see it. The big prizes, Masvidal undoubtedly is in that stratosphere, as we both said. Masvidal is looking at either a title shot or Conor. The Nate one, sure, I think that's, you know, potentially a great fight. But I think, you know, his eye is on those two prizes. He wants to win the title, or he wants to face Conor McGregor for the big money. I don't know that those are locks. I don't know that those are guarantees. Those are hard fish to catch. And so if I'm Leon Edwards, I see my opportunity as, look, he's kind of on the cusp. Masvidal is kind of on the cusp. He's right there, but he hasn't secured these opportunities yet. If I'm Leon Edwards, I don't think about title shot. I'm calling out Masvidal. That is my move. I am leaning into the three-piece in the soda. I'm saying that I want my chance to prove it, not take backstage cheap shots, and I'm going after Masvidal and doing everything I can to get that fight, to try and drum that up. Questioning manhood, whatever it takes. I'm putting that title shot on the back burner for the moment and trying to grab what I think is attainable but right out of reach, if I'm Leon.
Good point. He does have a better chance of getting that Masvidal fight now than getting a title shot, so it is an interesting point. It's crazy that Masvidal got away with this, you know? You don't see anyone saying, this fight has to happen. It's unfair to Leon Edwards. And I think that's because Edwards doesn't have the support of the people right now because he doesn't talk a lot, you know? And he doesn't have that buzz surrounding him. But maybe if he smokes RDA and then gets on the mic and says, Jorge Masvidal, you're a punk. You jump me backstage and then run away and take this easy fight against Ben Askren. Get out of here. Maybe we'll be talking about a potential Edwards Masvidal fight this time next week, because I really feel like it should happen. I just don't see it in the orbit right now. But that's a great point. Yep. It is definitely more attainable than a title shot. So maybe that's what he should go for. One last quick thing. Isn't it amazing that it's a Greg Hardy fight week and no one's really talking about Greg Hardy, even with Juan Adams, you know, being the first guy to really poke at him and bring up his past and criticize him for it? It feels like he's now just a part of the community. Like, he's just a guy on the roster. And maybe that's the best thing for Greg Hardy, right? Like, maybe him just blending in is what he really needs at this point. But it does seem 7 months or 6 months after his debut that he's just kind of there. And I don't know if that's people are just sort of, you know, numb to him or don't care or have accepted him. I don't know what it is. You tell me what you think, but it feels to me like he's just kind of there.
Yeah, I get that same feeling as well. I think people have you know, vociferously beat that drum when he was first signed and then put in the position that he was put in. But, you know, there's only so long that people can do that. And I think that is by design, you know, that the UFC anticipated that and wanted to put him out there nice and early and get these things out of the way. And then at a certain point, people are going to have to, you know, stop beating that drum just because they're tired of it. And there is no, there, it isn't an impacting change. It's not affecting anything. Greg Hardy is still in the same positions that he was in before. He's still near the top of a card. He's still getting a highlight spot, and nothing is changing. So I think, you know, people have been worn out essentially. And now Greg Hardy just becomes part of the roster. And I think it was by design. So, it's an interesting thing that Greg Hardy will be in this position again. And ultimately, if he wins this fight, I can only, you know, imagine how quickly he's going to be fast-tracked up the heavyweight division. But I don't think the conversation will ever, you know, go away completely. I think, you know, as he actually does ascend higher and higher, I think he's kind of in a middle spot now where he's kind of considered a prospect, but he's not really a guy who's, you know, knocking on the door of a title shot. As he does kind of climb higher there and ascend to those heights, I think these conversations will be brought back up, and that will be the time and the type of thing that will get people to be reinvigorated on that front. But I do think he's kind of, you know, coasting under the radar at this point, and it's the best thing for him if he's trying to focus on career and leave that behind. But we'll see what happens.
In addition to whether or not he's going to win, I'm curious about two things. I'm curious about, once they face off, whether it's at a media day or the weigh-ins on Friday, does Adams do something to really get under his skin, poke the bear even more? And if so, does Hardy react? Because he's done a good job of being, you know, a very well-behaved citizen right now. So I'm curious about that. I'm also curious, does he get cheered for the first time? Because this fight is happening in Texas and he's a former cowboy and, you know, he currently lives in Dallas. So I'm curious to see how that pans out. It's a fun card on paper. It's kind of flying under the radar, and maybe that's fitting because it's Leon Edwards and everything he does flies under the radar. But Edwards, Dos Anjos, Walt Harris, Alexei Olenek, Juan Adams, Greg Hardy, Dan Hooker coming back after that loss to Edson Barbosa in December. I'm curious to see how he looks against James Vick, who needs a win as well. Really interested in Alex Hernandez, seeing how he responds from that loss to Donald Cerrone. He talked a lot going into that fight and was humbled, so I'm curious about that. Francisco Trinaldo, he's going up against. And a fight that's 11 years in the making. 11 years ago, today's the 17th, so 11 years ago Friday, Andrei Arlovsky fought Ben Rothwell at Affliction Band, and now here they are fighting again 11 years and one day later. It's pretty amazing. Arlovsky won that fight, and now they're getting to do it again as elder statesmen, so that's a pretty fun story in its own right. All right, New York Rick, we are out of time. Thank you very much, my friend. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
There he is, New York Rick's own, or I should say Queen's own Yerk Rick, joining us as always to wrap up another fun edition. This was a fun one. Lots of good topics this week. Much to discuss. That was the main card. Alex Caceres is also on the prelims. That starts at 6 p.m. Eastern on ESPN, going up against Steven Patterson, Irene Aldana going up against Raquel Pennington, Sam Alvey, Jennifer Maya, Roxanne Modafferi, another rematch. Ray Borg on the card as well. So a lot to like on this San Antonio card. And I love the story of Andre Arlovsky and Ben Rothwell doing it again 11 years later. Isn't that amazing? July 19, 2008, one of the best nights in MMA history. That's when Affliction had their first show, Affliction Band. I was there in Anaheim, and UFC quickly put together a show on Spike TV for free to try to combat their pay-per-view. They had Anderson Silva in the main event against James Irvin. They threw Cain Velasquez and CB Dolloway, I believe Frankie Edgar as well, just to try to combat them. And it was so much fun covering the Affliction show and the Fyodor submission of Tim Sylvia, while also watching the Spike show. And back then, very rarely were there free cards, especially with Anderson Silva, who at the time was the 185-pound champion moving up to 205. And so that date, July 19th, is etched in my brain every time it comes up. Every single year, I think about that night covering the Affliction show in Anaheim. One of my first cards that I ever covered live. Good memories. That was when I first met Chael Sonnen for the first time. I posted that on Twitter earlier today as well. So great memories there. All right, we're out of time. Great show today. Appreciate everyone who stopped by. New York Rick, Mark Ramundi, Brett Okamoto. Thank you to Troy back in Bristol as well, as always, I should say. And thanks to all of you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading and rating and subscribing and continuing to support the MMA reporters right here on ESPN. Enjoy the fights this weekend. We'll talk to you next week.